Well, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure for me to be here today. As many of you know, the Australian economy has come through the worst global downturn since at least World War II, in better shape than many people had expected, and in sounder shape than in almost any other advanced economy. As a result of this, the challenges that we are likely to face in Australia over the coming years look to be quite different to the challenges that many other advanced economies are likely to face. This morning I'd like to talk about how we found ourselves in this relatively favourable position, and in particular about the importance of flexibility of our economy. I then want to touch on three of the broad challenges that I think our economy is going to face over the coming years. The first of these is to expand the supply side of the economy. The second is to increase the supply of housing for a rapidly growing population. And the third is the need to ensure that inflation remains low and stable. Before I talk about these challenges, though, I think it's useful to understand how we got to where we are. The various factors here are now pretty well understood. They include the substantial and early easing of both fiscal and monetary policy, the healthy state of our banking system, the rapid rebound in Asia, and particularly in China, the depreciation of the Australian dollar in 2008, and the relatively high rate of population growth in Australia. Collectively, these factors help us get through an extremely difficult period in the world economy. We shouldn't lose sight, though, of the fact that they didn't completely insulate us from the global downturn. The clearest example of this was a decline of GDP of almost 1% in the December quarter of 2008. But overall, I think it is fair to say that we've come through the downturn in much better shape than was widely expected. And the latest evidence of this was we got just last week when we, with the GDP numbers, which showed growth of 2.75% in calendar 2009. Now, there are various lessons that one can draw from this experience, but the one that I want to highlight today is the importance of flexibility. And here there are two aspects that I want to highlight. The first is the general flexibility of the economy to adjust to changes in the external environment. And the second is the flexibility that economic policy had to respond to changes in that environment. Without both of these aspects, the recent economic history of Australia, I think, would have looked quite different. This flexibility, though, didn't just materialise out of thin air. Instead, it was the result of many years of policy reform and hard work by governments and businesses. And I think what we've seen over the past 18 months is part of the dividend of that hard work, with the economic outcomes over the past year reflecting not just the decisions that were made from late 2008, but also the decisions that were made over the two or perhaps three decades before that. I'd like to touch on a few aspects of this flexibility which I think have been very important. The first is the flexibility of the exchange rate. And I think this has been one of the really great success stories of economic policy making in Australia. Without it, we would have seen bigger booms and we would have seen bigger busts and we would have seen more variable and probably higher inflation. As Rick Battalino, the RBA's deputy governor, discussed in a speech just a couple of weeks ago, the floating exchange rate has helped the economy adjust more smoothly to the boom in the resources sector than was the case in previous resource sector booms, which always ended in higher inflation. The flexibility of the exchange rate also helped the economy in 2008, when global risk aversion was at its peak. It helped during the Asian financial crisis of the mid to late 1990s, and it also helped when the US tech boom burst a decade ago. So I think it's been extremely important. The second area I want to focus on is labour market flexibility. As you all know, over the past year, the unemployment rate rose by considerably less than most people had expected. While this is partly due to the surprising strength of the economy, it's also the result of the flexibility that we now have in our labour market. When the demand for labour weakened, many firms and their employees got together and reduced working hours as a way of preserving jobs. In other cases, wage rises were delayed or postponed as a way of avoiding layoffs. I think it's undeniable that these responses help limit the rise in unemployment in Australia. In turn, this support helps incomes, and it helps support the general level of confidence in the community, and ultimately the level of economic activity in Australia. The third area of flexibility is macroeconomic policy. When the world took a sharp turn for the worse, fiscal policy in Australia responded quickly and on a significant scale. And it was able to do this without raising the fiscal sustainability concerns that have come to the fore in a number of other countries recently. While there will always be differences of opinion about the merits of specific fiscal measures, I think there can be little disagreement with the idea that Australia's history of sound fiscal policy provided the government the scope to act quickly and on a significant scale when the outlook deteriorated. One of the obvious benefits of keeping your house in order over a long period of time is that you can respond quickly and on a significant scale when circumstances change, if you think that's the right thing to do. And right now, there are many countries around the world that would clearly value that flexibility, but that don't have it because of the decisions made on fiscal policy running back at least a decade and probably two decades. Monetary policy was also able to respond rapidly when the outlook turned for the worst, with the cash rate being reduced by 4.25 percentage points over a seven-month period. Importantly, we're able to do this without causing inflation expectations and long-term interest rates to rise. And the main reason for this was that the monetary policy framework in Australia is seen as credible in ensuring that inflation will average 2 to 3% over time. But again, this credibility of the framework didn't just arise out of thin air. Instead, it's the result of nearly two decades of having delivered low and stable inflation around the target level. So in each of these areas, the exchange rate, the labour market, fiscal policy and monetary policy, the decisions that were made over a long period of time helped us get through the current global downturn. I think as we look forward, we shouldn't lose sight of this. As the Reserve Bank has pointed out a number of times recently, our central scenario for the Australian economy is a reasonably favourable one. In the central scenario, we are likely to face a two-speed global economy for some time. Most of the advanced economies are expected to experience only a subdued recovery weighed down by their balance sheet problems. But Asia is expected to grow quickly, with domestic demand in the region playing a more important role than it has done historically. If this is how things actually play out, Australia is well placed, particularly given its strong trade links with Asia and the generally bright outlook for the resources sector. But it's important to remember that this is only the central scenario. As we know, the global economy has a habit of throwing surprises, and there are clearly risks in both directions at the moment. Over recent months, the economic data for a number of countries have been stronger than expected, and it's possible that that could continue. On the other hand, it's possible that financial events in the advanced economies could again derail global growth, and growth in Asia could disappoint. Now, we clearly can't control the external environment that we face, but what we can do is to preserve the flexibility that the economy has and enhance that flexibility wherever we can. Ultimately, that's the best insurance that we can have against the uncertain world in which we live. I now want to turn to the three issues that I mentioned at the outset, the supply side of the economy, housing and inflation control. And in each of these areas, the situation in Australia is quite different to that facing most of the other advanced economies. So if we start with the supply side, Australia starts the current expansion with considerably less spare capacity than earlier thought likely, and with less spare capacity than the starting points of previous expansions. And you can see this from the top panel of this first graph here, which shows capacity utilisation as measured by the business surveys. That's the top panel. It's also clear in the labour market data, as you can see in the bottom panel, the unemployment rate in Australia peaked at around 5.75%, which was around the trough in the previous cycles. Now, these outcomes put Australia in a very different spot from most of the other advanced economies. In both the US and in Europe, the unemployment rate's around 10%, and both of these economies are estimated to be operating with at least 5% spare capacity. The issues we face are therefore quite different from those confronting these economies. Elsewhere, the challenge seems to be to get private demand to grow on a sustainable basis so that it can catch up with the supply side of the economy. In contrast, for us, the main task is to expand the supply side of the economy so that demand can grow solidly without causing inflation to rise. This is an unambiguously better position to be in, but it does pose some challenges. Now, the obvious keys to improving the supply side of the economy are investment and productivity growth. In terms of investment, we're doing very well, with Australia having become a high investment economy. Currently, business investment is equivalent to around 16% of GDP. As you can see from this chart, that's not far below its peak level over the past four decades, and I expect it to rise further over the next couple of years. Investment in the resources sector has been particularly strong, and this is now starting to bear fruit, with resource exports having risen recently after a period where there was very little growth. And again, looking forward, expect further significant increases in resource sector investment and resource sector exports. The high overall rate of investment means the capital stock in Australia is increasing at a faster rate than it has for many decades, and this should continue to underpin expansion of the supply side of the economy. In contrast, in a number of advanced economies, including the United States, there is currently little net growth at all in the capital stock, with the investment that is taking place in that economy barely enough to offset the depreciation of the existing capital. And now, the fact that investment in Australia is high reflects the fact that the return on capital in Australia is high, particularly in the resources sector. And given that countries with relatively high returns on capital typically have relatively high real interest rates, it shouldn't be surprising that interest rates in Australia are above those in countries where the return on capital is much lower than in Australia. In terms of productivity, the story isn't as positive, although there are always measurement issues that cloud the picture. According to the ABS, since the mid-2000s, all the increase in output in Australia has been accounted for by a rise in hours worked and an increase in the capital stock. Or put another way, there's been very little underlying productivity growth over this period. You can see this in this chart, which shows multi-factor productivity growth, that is, taking account of both labour and capital inputs. Now, the reasons for this relatively weak productivity growth aren't particularly clear. Some slowing in productivity growth might have been expected at the mature stage of the business cycle, as the economy was operating against its capacity limits. A second possibility is that the high commodity prices allowed lower grade resources to be mined, and the lag between construction and production means that some of the large projects come into fruition, we may get more output from those, and productivity growth will improve. More generally, though, I think it's important to remember that the least productive thing that a society can do is to leave large numbers of people sitting at home who actually want to work. And from this perspective, the productivity performance over the past decade looks to be quite a lot better. The Australian economy has done a very good job at bringing into paid employment those who actually want to work, and as you saw before, the unemployment rate's come down. One side effect of this is that it has contained productivity growth as conventionally measured. But from a broader societal perspective, I think this represents a considerable success. Now, as we go forward, if we're to go strongly on a sustainable basis, we will need to ensure that both our capital and our workforce are used as efficiently as possible. I return to my earlier theme, maintaining flexibility in the economy is incredibly important here. Under the central scenario that I sketched earlier, the economy is likely to be undergoing considerable structural change, particularly as the resource sector grows, and how well we deal with this structural change will have a significant impact on how the overall economy performs. Now I want to turn to the second issue, that of housing. Here again, Australia finds itself in quite a different position to that of most other advanced economies in terms of both the construction cycle and prices. One challenge we face is to satisfy the increase in the demand for housing from a growing population, particularly given that we start the current upswing in the economy with a fairly tight housing market. As you can see from this next graph, Australia did not have an unsustainable surge in dwelling investment in the middle years of the 2000s that resulted in oversupply. And this is in sharp contrast to the experience of a number of other countries, the most notable examples of the US and Spain, which had very large housing cycles and a lot of overbuilding. In fact, in Australia over recent years, the rate of increase in the number of dwellings has been below the average of the past 50 years. You can see that in the blue line there. In stark contrast to this, the rate of increase in the population has been around the fastest in 50 years. Now, consistent with this, rental vacancy rates in Australia are low by historical standards, although they've increased a little bit recently. There's also been a reversal of a decades-long trend to fewer people living in each dwelling. While demographic factors have been important here, so too has been the increase in the cost of housing. With population growth above average and growth in the housing stock below average, it's not surprising that there's been upward pressure on housing costs as part of the process of equilibrating supply and demand, with the higher housing costs leading people to economise on housing services. And obvious examples of this are the trend towards young adults staying in the parental home longer and a rise in the number of people sharing accommodation. Now, interestingly, the relatively slow growth in the number of dwellings does not reflect historically low levels of dwelling investment. You can see this in this next chart, which shows dwelling investment as a share of GDP, which over recent years has actually been above the average of the past five decades. However, within the total dwelling investment, renovation activity now accounts for a higher share than was the case historically. You can see that in the orange line at the bottom. And the average size and quality of new dwellings has also increased substantially. The result of these changes is that for a given share of GDP devoted to housing investment, there is a smaller increase in the number of dwellings than was the case previously. In a sense, as a society, we've traded off quality for quantity. In particular, we've implicitly chosen to build bigger and better appointed dwellings rather than more dwellings. Looking forward, if the population growth is to remain strong for an extended period and we don't change the mix of housing that we're building, it's likely that we will need to devote a higher share of GDP to housing than has been the case historically. And if this doesn't happen, then further adjustment in housing prices and rents is likely to occur to balance the supply and demand. I think this raises two important questions that we need to think about. The first is the constraints that currently exist on increasing the supply of dwellings. If we are to build more dwellings, we need to ensure the planning guidelines and infrastructure provision can accommodate this, and this will obviously pose challenges for all levels of government. And the second issue is the capacity of the economy to deal with an increase in dwelling construction at the same time when investment elsewhere is very high. If housing construction is very strong, at the same time the resource sector is expanding, there will obviously be competing demands for a range of skilled workers and specialised services. Managing these competing demands and ensuring the adequate supply of workers with appropriate skills is a significant challenge for us. The third issue that I want to touch on is inflation. In all the advanced economies, inflation in both headline and core terms has fallen, and in most cases is currently below the target or the medium-term average in that country. Given the considerable excess capacity that currently exists, most of these countries are likely to continue experiencing disinflationary pressures for some time, and inflation rates are likely to be below target. In Australia, inflation's also fallen, but unlike for most of the other advanced economies, it's not expected to be below the target for an extended period. In the December quarter of last year, underlying inflation was running at an annualised rate of around 2.5%, right at the midpoint of the target range. In annual terms, underlying inflation was higher than this, reflecting the higher quarterly outcomes in the early part of 2009. As we look forward, we expect broadly similar outcomes over the next year as that recorded in the December quarter, with the lagged effects of slower wage growth and the appreciation of the exchange rate continuing to work their way through. As we set out in our latest statement on monetary policy, we expect inflation in both headline and underlying terms to be around 2.5% this year and just a little higher next year. Now, recently there's been some discussion, prompted by senior staff at the International Monetary Fund, that central banks might aim for higher inflation, say 4%, as a way of giving them more scope to reduce interest rates in future downturns. This idea does not seem particularly sensible to me. As history has taught us, inflation distorts decision-making in the economy, it discourages saving, and it increases uncertainty about the future. None of these things are helpful for expanding the supply side of the economy, and ultimately, higher inflation just means higher nominal interest rates. Equally importantly, a global shift to allow higher inflation would run the very real risk of undermining trust in central banks and their commitment to price stability. The public might rightly wonder whether inflation targets might shift up again at some future point as other problems arose. If this loss of trust were to occur, we would have given up the very hard-won credibility in the monetary policy frameworks that has been built up over the past couple of decades. So just to finish, the central scenario for the Australian economy is a very positive one, with growth over the next couple of years around average, a relatively strong labour market, and inflation consistent with the medium-term target. There are, however, risks around this central scenario that we're going to need to watch carefully. The recent experience has reminded us of the importance of flexibility of both the economy and macro policy in managing these risks. As we look forward, if something like the central scenario were to eventuate, we will need to keep a strong focus on improving the supply side of the economy so that demand can grow solidly without putting upward pressure on inflation. We also face the very significant challenge of increasing the supply of housing when a time that business investment is also very high. Meeting these challenges will require both hard work by both governments and businesses, but there are surely better challenges to face than those confronting many of the other advanced economies of the world. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Hello, Jeff Weinstock, the Australian Financial Review. I just wanted to ask a question about the processes and accuracy of the RBA's economic forecasting. I'm sure we all agree that the RBA's forecasts are very influential and a very crucial part of what the RBA does. I noticed in your speech you pointed out how surprisingly strong the Australian economy had been, and in fact, we just found out that the Australian economy grew by 2.75% in last year. About this time last year, the RBA was forecasting that the Australian economy would only grow by about 0.25% in 2009. So I think that's a fairly significant underestimation of what was happening in the Australian economy over the last year. I was wondering if you've thought at the RBA about why that underestimation occurred, if there are any reasons for it. I know the RBA wasn't alone in underestimating the strength of the Australian economy, but I also know that some people, particularly those who relied on formal economic models, were much more accurate in their forecasts. I wonder if you had a thought about changes in approach that you need as a result of that?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. The early part of last year, I think if you wind the clock back, it was a very unsettling period. I mean, there were serious commentators around the world talking about the very real possibility that the global economy could revisit the depression of the 1930s. Risk aversion was extreme. Capital markets had broken down. International trade was falling. Industrial production was falling globally. So there was a very real risk that the global economy could have gone into a much more serious downturn. Governments around the world and central banks responded to that and took off some of those tail risks. I think in general, as you say, things have turned out better than expected. But that's because the policy responses of governments around the world did effectively stabilise financial markets. They stopped the collapse of confidence. They stopped the corrosion in international trade. I think the other thing that surprised many people is the very strong rebound in Asia. The Chinese fiscal stimulus was larger than many people had thought and turned out to have a much quicker effect on Chinese growth than many people had thought. So I don't think the fact that the economy's turned out better than we generally expected calls for wholesale revision in economic forecasting. I think that period last year was incredibly uncertain. And things have turned out better than expected, but I don't think that it was in that environment last year. If people had predicted that the Australian economy was going to grow by nearly 3% last year, I don't think anyone would have found that credible. A relatively small, more people though, remember, were talking about a global depression. Now, there's always a range of forecasts out there, but the predominance of opinion was that this was a very, very difficult period, and if policy was not managed carefully, the world economy could have had a much more serious downturn than the one we've experienced.
Dr. Lo, Kai Chow from the Sky News Business Channel. I wondered what your assessment was of the state of business at the moment. I mean, you've often talked about the strength of our housing market, but businesses are facing, for example, a high Australian dollar. They're still finding it hard to get lending. The Reserve often doesn't talk about the state of that industry, so I'm just wondering your thoughts on how that part of the economy is progressing.
Yeah. Well, we talk to a lot of businesses through our liaison program. We talk to more than 100 each month, and we also obviously watch the business surveys of the various organisations very carefully. And my characterisation would be that businesses are generally confident, but they're still cautious. One legacy of the global downturn is that people are, I think, more nervous or more careful than they were previously. So businesses report very high levels of confidence, but when you actually go and ask them about their capital spending plans, they're actually still a bit below average. The exception of this is obviously the mining sector. So I think that's the right characterisation, confident but cautious. The other observation I'd make here is that at the margin, I think businesses are finding it a little easier to access finance, or I should say not as difficult to access finance. For much of last year, we heard through our liaison that it was very difficult for firms to get funding. But gradually through the latter part of last year and early into this year, I think that's starting to ease up. And that's good for investment, and it's generally good for confidence in the business sector.
Well, just as a follow-up, how do you see the job market then? You mentioned flexibility being important before, being able to reduce the amount of hours people are working now. I mean, at the moment, the number of hours people are working, wages, they're still falling, even though the number of jobs has increased. So what's your net assessment of how our job market is?
Well, it's hard to escape any other conclusion that the market's fairly strong. That the job ads are rising. Again, the business surveys, when firms are asked about their hiring plans, show strong increases. The number of people on unemployment benefits has actually declined in the past couple of months, and employment has grown strongly. There is a puzzle about the hours worked. I think that's probably a harder thing to measure than total employment, because the ABS comes and asks you, have you got a job? That's fairly easy to answer yes or no. How many hours did you work? I think that's more difficult to answer. So I think the measurement issues are more significant there. The overall impression, though, is from the various things we look at, is the labour market still quite strong.
Phil Lasker from... Oh, someone else? Phil Lasker from the ABC.
Sorry.
It's all journalists, it seems, this morning. I'll keep my questions brief. There are two questions, so you can have more time, actually. You talked about a lot of investment going into renovations and building bigger houses. To what extent do you see that as a result of the tax laws and the fact that the family home might be the only tax haven in this country? To what extent does that encourage that sort of trend? And what worries you about China?
I think the fact that renovation activity has been so strong reflects the desire of people to live in better quality houses as their income grows. You see this right around the world. So I don't think it's predominantly tax-driven. It's driven by the desire to actually live in bigger and better homes as our incomes rise. And as our incomes rise, we can afford to do that. And so we renovate our houses and live in bigger houses. On China, the issue that there are various concerns. The one that I have worried about is that the stimulus would stay in place for too long, and you'd either get problems in asset markets or inflation rising. But the Chinese authorities actually have started tightening up. They've increased the reserve requirements on banks, and they've given a very strong signal to many of the banks to rein in lending. So I think that's encouraging. The fact that they have been prepared to take steps to rein in what was a very strong economy increases the probability of the longevity of the current expansion. So I think that's actually good news for us, and I suspect we'll see further steps in that direction over the coming months.
Yes, Philip, Rudy Colkman, Campbelltown Council, New South Wales. Touching on housing, which you did refer to, and the shortage in supply, the New South Wales government has placed a ceiling on developer contributions with the specific aim of reducing the price of developing land so that housing becomes more affordable. There are no controls in place, to the best of my knowledge, that require developers to pass all of those savings on to individual land buyers so they can build their homes. Is there a role for government to regulate the price that land is sold, taking into account the limit that it has imposed upon developer contributions?
Well, I'm not an expert in the details here, so I'd rather not answer the specifics of your question. But I think the general point here that I'm trying to emphasise is that the population growth in Australia at the moment is very strong, but the rate at which we're adding to the number of dwellings is not particularly strong. And if that continues, then we're going to face some stresses in the housing market. I think we need to look at all aspects of the planning process, of the land release process, of the zoning process, because if we are going to continue to have population growth at anything like the current rate, we need to build quite a lot more dwellings. But I'm sorry, I'm not sufficiently well-versed in the specifics to be able to answer your question.
Thank you.
Hi, Rob Papalea from Charnock & Cramer, not a journalist. From the industry point of view, obviously one of the big issues that they're facing, or that we're facing, relates to the ability to gain finance for development and construction. Obviously, the bank seems to be fairly happy to lend to the end purchasers, but I suppose in the long term, you've identified that there are some supply constraints, and one of the biggest ones is the ability to access finance. Where does the Reserve Bank see that going?
Yeah, we've certainly seen, both talking to the banks and to people in the industry, that it's been very difficult in the commercial property industry to get finance, and that's been a very strong theme running through the last year and a bit. From the bank's perspective, they see commercial property as the most risky part of their portfolio. and historically that's certainly been the case. And so they had a reluctance to increase their exposure to that area over the last year and a half. I think we're starting to see things ease up just a little bit. If the economy continues to improve as we expect it will, I think the banks will again look at that sector in a bit more favourable light. We, as I said, we haven't had overbuilding in housing, and as a general characterisation, we haven't had overbuilding in office and commercial property either. So I think the broad fundamentals that are sound, provided the economy does behaves pretty much like the central scenario. And I think that we'll see as a result of that some gradual easing, but it's still very difficult at the moment. Okay, well, thank you very much.